Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the show. I got to tell you that I've gone back and forth on this episode on whether or not I was going to publish it as a One Broken Mom episode, or whether or not I was going to publish it as the Fearless Woman's Guide to Business episode. And then I've decided that probably by the time you all are listening to this, you could be listening to it on both platforms at one or another, because there's a crossover between it. I have with me Richa Badami, who's been on the show before. So if you've actually listened to One Broken Mom, you'll remember that she and I had a very vulnerable conversation telling her experience with being a sexual abuse survivor, an incest survivor. And actually, we discussed and she shared with us the cultural implications that influenced how it was addressed as it was happening, the help that she got or didn't get, and, you know, how it ended up, you know, kind of forming her into the woman that she is today in the services and the work that she actually does with helping others with trauma survival. And in Richa and I have had an opportunity to collaborate a couple of times on some of her programs that she's actually doing. And during one of the conversations, I think we were just catching up. It was like COVID. It's like, what are you up to? I don't know. Let's get on the phone and let's just talk. And I was speaking with her about the, my intersections and my, you know, kind of sharpening my focus for, my steps forward in this chapter in my life, which is the combination of everything that I've been doing with trauma healing on my personal journey, but also sharing it as through the resources like One Broken Mom, and how it's overlapping and now becoming very synchronous with what I've been doing, which is I'm an entrepreneur and I'm a businesswoman. You know, I've worked in organizations and I've done some coaching over the years, one-on-one with businesses and solopreneurs. But my metamorphosis that I think everybody's really going to start to see a lot more here is into actually working with organizations on trauma-informed practices and leadership skills. And so when we were chatting about this, I had said, yeah, you know how often workplaces trigger us or they re-traumatize us. And then Richa was like, oh my God, and shared with me this story that I was like, okay, stop. We have to talk about this if you want to, so that other people can hear this, because I believe this happens in ways that most people don't think about being re-triggered or re-traumatized as a trauma survivor, but also what my, you know, my kind of vigilante work is now is teaching people that work within organizations that create environments to be aware of how things like Reach's experience that you're going to share with us happen, and how, you know, that sensitivity is really important in interpersonal communications and how we manage and even just what we say in the language that we use. And so Richa, thank you so much for coming back on and being able to talk about your experience. Cause I mean, you know, I know this isn't an easy thing to do. And so I admire you for having that strength. Anybody who's listening to this, I just saw you take a deep breath and I have to take a deep breath too. Remember, we talk about topics that can be triggering. And so self-care is always important. And so if anybody listens to some of this and starts to feel it, remember, hit the pause button, you know, however you need to take some deep breaths. Don't push yourself through something that starts to feel uncomfortable. And same to you, Richa, as we're discussing this. So again, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you. It's so easy to talk to you. And I, you know, could do that for hours. You know, when you said the vigilante, I was like, where was Ami when I needed her? Because it's literally, I think it's almost, while we're recording this, I think it's exactly about, it's 14 years and maybe a day or so that episode that I talked to you about the other day happened. And even while you were sort of sharing that with your audience, like you noticed me take a deep breath. Because even now, even though I know I'm physically safe, I'm emotionally safe, no one's around me, but that even now, that even I've done all this work, like there was that little bit of flutter in my stomach and like in my abdomen. And I know I'm safe, but yet there's that teeny tiny bit, because it's not no joke. Like the impact of people's words, the energy and the space and the container that they hold is so, so important, especially for those of us who have been through trauma. So take you back in a little time machine into the events that occurred. And, you know, you'd also ask, like, you know, what happened after that? Did you ever... you know, what happened to your work after that? And I'll tell you at the end what happened to my work after that. But yeah, so about actually 20 years ago, when I moved to the US from India, I was, you know, brand new to the country, just, you know, trying to figure out my ropes. But I took a job and I ended up being in the, starting out in the mortgage business, because that was the industry that was like full on hiring back then. It was really easy getting in an entry level job. Anyway, I very quickly went from entry level to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And within 2 years, I was producing mortgages. I was interviewing people for their loans and getting them homes and financing and everything. And so I was with this company for about, I think, 6 years. I left at the sixth year mark, but one of those years where this was like after the, like a halfway through, maybe, or when things were starting to get a little bit more challenging for the business in the 2000s.
Yeah, the recession and the real estate bubble and all that stuff that started to happen. Yep.
Yeah, 2008-ish it was. And I remember we would have regular, you know, Monday sales meeting, quarterly sales meetings and all these meetings for business building and everything. And they were along the years, there were all these, you know, cultural sort of snarky, like jokes and like, you know, slights and remarks that I would just like brush them off. I would never like really get into any of that. But this one time left me speechless and rot. Like I didn't even realize how bad it was until a long time until later. And so in this rah-rah sort of sales meeting, we had regional manager and then the team manager, and I was, you know, an independent account executive, I guess you could call me. And it was just a conference room. It wasn't this huge place. So it was a conference room, and I was no more than maybe 4 feet away from him. And we were talking, he was talking about how everyone needs to do more sales and needs to, you know, produce more loans and get out there and do that. And at the end, right while we were finishing up, and he said, and he looked right at me, and you need to be a mortgage whore. Ugh, even just saying that right now is like, you know, I did not tell anyone, say anything to anyone, so much so that when I left the room, my immediate manager, I have to give him credit for that, came and said, are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm fine. It's like, you know, boys will be boys, you know. I did that whole thing and I just went on, but I was not okay. And I had no one to talk to. I didn't even know how to make sense of it, other than to dismiss it by saying boys will be boys and just move the F on, you know, from it. But that was the last corporate job I had. So just to bridge the gap from what happened that day to what happened to my life, was I somewhere made that decision that it's not safe. Mm-hmm. I cannot trust my safety. I cannot trust my being. There's something in me that wants to get out of here and I won't be safe here. And so when the first opportunity came to transition out of it, I think that opportunity showed itself in the form of a pregnancy. So yeah, 14 years. I decided that, yeah, enough is enough. I'm out of here. And so I actually left. And I resigned. And actually, it's exactly that month that I resigned, because they were surprised. Like, oh, why are you resigning? You're doing so well. I'm like, no, I'm done. And yeah. You know, I feel like, oh, I could have said something, I could have done something, I could have complained, but there were no avenues or space, there was no conversation, there was no dialogue, there was just no languaging around it. So, you know, that being said, when you explained what you're doing now, it just makes me so, so happy. To create a safer place for not only our peers, the women, the younger women, the, you know, millennials, and then we have our children, like our teenagers, who are going to be very soon, in like 6 years or sooner, in fact, they will be in the workplace. And come on, you know, we've got to do everything we can. And so I'm just so, thank you I'm literally getting full body chills saying thank you to you. Like, that's how much gratitude I have for this. It is so important. Like, so many people are asking me about trauma-informed meditation and trauma-informed this. And yes, 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 more. Let's do this, like, now. Mm-hmm. We need everyone educated.
And thank you for that. And I appreciate that. The thing that I remember when you and I talked about this that struck me was that's a statement. Let's take apart this gentleman's, you know, stupid statement that he made at you and cast at you. We're recording this in the midst of March, which is Women's History Month, which is an attempt to be able to put women back into history where they belonged with their achievements and things that they've contributed to culture and society that we've just, you know, not, you know, acknowledge for some time. And so words like that, you know, obviously have this misogynistic undertone to it, like, you know, equating success with being a whore. But for you, I remember when we talked about this, and that's why I'm hoping that you feel like you're in a space where you can share this, is in work spaces, sometimes we say things like, you talked about microaggressions, like it's no big deal to make jokes about people's race or their gender, in this case, you know, sexuality. And it's not, and we don't know the room. And when you look at statistics where 1 in 5 women have experienced sexual assault, and then you actually look at other research statistics that say that probably up to 3 out of 10 women have been raped or sexually assaulted by a partner, or, you know, have experienced domestic violence, we don't know who's sitting in the room with us and what their history actually is. And in this case here, this comment that somebody thought they were being funny actually really hurt you in a deep, deep way. And they had no idea. And I think when you were saying this to it took you a while to kind of make those connections. Like, you had an instant physical reaction to this, right? Like, that was something that struck me, was that these words, I mean, they really did, you know, cause this deeply empathetic response and re-traumatization. Would you like to share a little bit about like what had been going through your head when you heard those words like that? Cause I think that's the power behind that. I mean, that's part of the power behind this.
No, I think you bring up a really good thread from that conversation that we had. And I feel like a bomb exploded inside me, is how the physical feeling felt. But I couldn't make sense of it. Like, it was like in the aftermath of an internal explosion. And I'm trying to like figure out, where did this come from? What was this explosion? Like, you're trying to like understand, you know, reverse engineer it. And this is really, you know, to be really open about this, the fact is, or was for me, is that there was so much shame that I had been living with and hiding and burying it down. Because at that stage, I don't believe I had even spoken openly about my childhood sexual abuse to my own husband. Like, I was married to Cash for, by then, 9 years or 8 years. We had had two children together already. But I hadn't even told him about my childhood sexual abuse. And so I had locked that thing down deep. And because I came into my marriage with my husband thinking, all that was in the past. I did my inner work. My dad and I are cool now. And my dad and I had done the healing work and transformation work before I married my husband. And yet, when I had my children and when I was in a marriage, like, there were little things that started to get open up that I didn't know how to deal with that were new. Even though, you know, you go through that as a survivor, you go through those different milestones, even though you've done the work. So it's like a continuous maintenance program you've got to kind of be in. So I didn't know that. And, you know, the biggest thing that nobody knew, especially not this clueless, you know, boss, was that I had considered prostitution as a child. Because that was the, I have to take a moment because that was the avenue that I thought I had to take in life from how I felt at the time as a teenager. Look what's happening to my throat. Like, and my voice has been cracking because it's, I've never really said this out. Like, the physical body, our body is so wise. Like, this, like, the body knows. Like, this is just a demonstration of, like, when something is happening in our physical body to see, like, it's so meaningful. I remember, you know, I'm Indian. I'm from, like, grew up, raised, and went to school. And if anyone knows the Asian stereotype of, like, you got to study, you got to get good marks, you got to get into engineering. And that was the generation I grew up in. I think to a large extent, it still is. So while my, what we call them, there were board exams. So 10th grade and 12th grade were board exams. So state exams and central exams, which is nationwide for placement in colleges. So while my peers were studying for their entrance exams, engineering and, you know, and medicine and, like, these big time exams, I'm thinking, yeah, prostitution, probably. That's probably my best avenue. Like, I'm not going to do any of that. So all this to say is that such shame was in my body. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, the body keeps the score and all the work that, you know, Wessel van der Kolk, and, you know, we have all, so much there is today, right? Like, Bruce Lipton, Joe Dispenza, like, our body, our emotions, our everything is, like, there's so much in there, locked in, and on a cellular level, that when those words landed in these, just these two, you know, holes on the sides of my face called ears, like, what's the big deal, right? They're just words, right? But boy, those sound waves created this explosion. And then this explosion started a whole wave of other things. So on in the reality of what was happening, the iceberg was, like, massive. And what we were seeing was just the tip of the iceberg. And so It was so much more. And I hope I'm answering and addressing the question.
You are. And I hope that, again, I don't want this to be something that, you know, I know sometimes when we leave these interviews with multitudes of guests, and I'm sure that maybe you even experience this with the work that you do, sometimes we have to recover from it, or in the moment we're we experience it vicariously. That's always a danger of, you know, my job here is feeling all of this with you and doing that. And so I want to make sure that, you know, this is pacing in a way that you do still feel safe talking about all of this, because I know that this is very difficult And you have answered it, intention here and not at your expense. I just want to make that clear, Richa, is you mentioned this great word, icebergs, right? Yeah. When we show up in life, people rarely see the depth of everything else that's actually floating beneath the surface. And holding everybody personally accountable for their depth of iceberg is fine. It's fair. It's fair for us to eventually, and honestly, we are the only people that can heal ourselves, regardless if we're the reasons that we have things to heal, right? None of that happened was our fault. It wasn't your fault that you were abused. But yet we're also, I believe, accountable to each other to understand the depth of this, that there is this universality that a lot of us have experienced varying degrees, of traumatic experiences. And none of them are better or worse or, larger or smaller or whatever it is. They are just who they are and what they are to us. And I think sometimes we only understand that when we can hear the stories of other people like this, and the context, which seems harmless, right? The business meeting room, and just trying to motivate the team, with whatever words it needs to be. And again, using languaging and words that wouldn't fly today. I can't imagine it now, especially in the wake of Me Too, than any supervisor, but they're still used in meeting rooms around locker room talk. Boys will be boys, I didn't mean it that way. That's the other thing that people use to couch those statements, but that doesn't mean that you can't end up inflicting a wound. And you bring up a great example here of showing that we don't always know where our landmines are. We don't even know sometimes until we've stepped on it. And as you described that internal explosion, like I know that feeling of like this, whoa, I just got blasted with this rise of, fighting or fleeing or freezing or something that's going on. And now I need to resolve that. And I'm in the heat of the moment and I don't know how to make sense of it right now. And I think that's important, that you've shared with us is that.
That dysregulation happens, right? Which we're very familiar with dysregulation. Mm-hmm. And I see the circuits get, I tell my husband, I feel like my circuits are shutting down. My circuits shut down. I cannot make sense of this. I need time to get back on track. re-regulate. I didn't know that word. I used to call it my circuits are fried. I can't think straight. That's right. It.
Yeah, which is fair, which happens when, we've been triggered and traumatized like this, or in this case, re-traumatized. Now, from the business perspective, again, that's part of this. What do you think could have anything have changed or happened within the confines of your work experience that could have helped support you in this way? Or was it were you just done as soon as it happened? It was over.
Well, after that incident, it was very hard to be in relationship. I didn't know at the time the importance of the work in boundaries, frankly. That was, 15 years ago. And so I think boundaries, if there were any in the workplace other than just, good morning and good evening and all of that nonsense, actual boundaries of how to treat people and how to honor people's sovereignty and, those things that we talk about now, that if we had that conversation, that would have made, we would have known, in all the sales trainings on how to use your, how to use your vacation days and how to file your expenses, all these, rubbish things instead of actual meaningful things, how to be with each other and how to support each other, how to make this a synergistic place so everyone is successful, not just the bottom line, but as people, we are all, living a happier life, the hierarchy of needs, right? The Maslow pyramid, it reminds me of actually in the Indian culture, there's a Vedic there's an Indian teaching of how to, you start with the basics and then you work towards self-actualization is at the top of the pyramid, just like in Maslow's theory. It's very similar. It's very interesting. But But that's not how it was. If I had a way to, like, if it had been different, and which would have been maybe supportive, would have been having a neutral party who, or somebody who knows how to hold the container of safety for board meetings, or somebody watching, listening. I see this someone who's there making sure that things are being handled, like witnessing that people are on, I don't know if that's the right way, like on their best behavior or whatever, but I don't think it's so much about best behavior as being grounded in humanity. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's like so basic.
Mm-hmm.
Be nice and be nice, like be respectful, be safe.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about, the microaggressions, the jokes and the stuff that, was commonplace that you just kind of like let it roll and stuff like that. I think that's another thing that people, are guilty of, saying things and not thinking that they're really that big of a deal, that like, well, it's not really a slur, or they're saying it with some intention. That the stereotype is supposed to be a positive stereotype, the commentary that they're making, and not realizing that still in some way that it can be still racist, and it's not, it's still not okay to happen in the workspace. And, for you, woman, India, working in America, how did you approach when you heard microaggressions and things like that? You already mentioned you just kind of like let it go, but how did it actually make you feel to have to be in a workplace environment that had it?
I would go into my office and sometimes I would cry. I would go in my office and sometimes I would cry. And then come back out with a smile on my face, and like nothing happened. Just things like about music and this assumption that because you're from India, there are cows everywhere, there is, you're not educated, you can't speak English, and like you have this, how is your English so good? There were people who would assume that you're uneducated and you are poor and you didn't grow up with anything. It's just so silly. They have no idea. They mm-hmm. don't know you. Like, they haven't really come to get to know you. If anyone wanted to get to know me, they'd know what life I had. I was in Bollywood. I had an entourage of 5 people all the time. So it's not like, they have a clue of my background. And it was just, I was, as it is, pretty alone. I didn't have a lot of friends. I was pretty alone and isolated in a sense. And then to also, for people not to have any curiosity, or I guess I was also just going through my own things, it was kind of wasn't really very helpful to blend with people who had that kind of outlook towards you. There was those microaggressions, and also a friend of mine who was from Iran was helping a community in which there were a lot of Muslim applicants. And I remember this time, and why she left was someone came to her desk and threw down her files and said, "Here are your terrorist files."
Oh my gosh.
And that's when she left. "Here are all your terrorist loans or terrorist files." So I was shocked when I heard that. And then within a few months, that happened to me. And I'm like, wow. Yeah, she never worked for them also again. And so one by one, the women who were not like the rest of them, basically white women, were gone. There mm-hmm. was an African-American employee, Iranian, and then me. We were all out of there because we weren't like them.
Mm-hmm. Did you seem to see if the white women in the office got their own version of gender bias or anything?
I don't know, because they hung out with the white boys more. They were invited more. They were happy hour more. They had more Christmases together. We were still on the outside, you know. And so I never really got to be friends with them. And actually, even now, they're still working together. They're actually still all together. And it's been 20 years. They're all one big happy family. I mean, I moved on from that business in 2008. It was just something I was doing for survival. It wasn't like my passion. I was really good at it. I learned things fast, and I got really good really fast. And I thought, okay, I guess I'm successful, so I should be doing it because I'm successful. But that wasn't, as you've learned, just because you're really good at something, doesn't mean you're passionate about it.
Right, right. Did you ever have any doubts or questions in yourself when you were thinking like, this isn't a good fit for me, but I don't know what to do, or should I leave? I mean, you mentioned, and I can sympathize with that. Sometimes we feel like we're still stuck and we can't move out and move onward. And I've seen this in a couple of other groups that I'm involved with, you know, women that really question whether or not they should leave a toxic situation, you know, and then, and kind of stay in it thinking, you know, that maybe it'll get better. Maybe they should do something. Maybe they should educate their boss or their coworkers or whatever it is, or they just don't know, like, are they reading the situation correctly? Like, is this toxic, you know, that this actually happened? Did you have any kind of, you know, those feelings as you were, you know, after this moment happened and then you're kind of surviving now your day to day in this work environment?
Yeah. You know, I don't think I knew how to name it. Like, I didn't have the language. All I knew is it didn't feel good. And I think that I took the tactic of becoming reverse aggressive. So finding ways to sort of maybe use, you know, my words or language to kind of poke fun at them. Like, I tried to become like them, which made me even feel more sick about being there. Because I'm like, why am I turning into this, you know? Why am I talking like this? Why am I being sarcastic? And then I realized I was doing it just to, you know, counter any possible attack, verbal attack that might come from them. I was kind of becoming like that. So I was starting to be not, you know, exactly who I am, you know, which is pretty laid back and mind my own business. But yeah, I was on high alert. So I don't think I knew how to name it. And again, that goes back to, I think, the education and knowing the signs and being able to recognize it and being able to call it out so that it doesn't actually become this cellular, visceral impact. So that you can catch it and go, oh, this is what that's like. This is here, and this goes in this column, which is like a no-no, the no-no column. And now I know what to do because I know it belongs here. This is not okay. And you behave this way, and this is not okay. And so you know how to have those boundaries, which I didn't have. Growing up, I didn't have them. I didn't have them till much later, I would say in my 30s, you know. To actually start to even to recognize in my body that there's something being violated, I need to stop it. And then took me more years to actually learn how to stop it and then learn how to practice holding boundaries, which, as you know, is life's work. We can all type up boundaries like, these are my boundaries. And like, okay, now I try to hold them.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to draw a line. I swear I'm going to hold it.
And yeah. That's a whole other thing. Yeah.
Well, so you never went back to corporate after this because you didn't trust that those were safe places for you with this experience there, which I think, you know, a lot of people can resonate with and feel that. Like, you know, again, talking about the fact that without this awareness that, you know, trauma exists everywhere and that we can set that off and the environment can exacerbate that for people. I think that that's a, like I said, that's a completely fair, you know, judgment, you know, of the corporate system to not go there. So what did you do after that? Where did you go? Knowing that your body needs a safe place. Your brain and mind and your spirit needs to be in emotionally and socially safe places. How did you start to create that for yourself?
You know, I took the time to, as I'd mentioned, I was pregnant. And so I took the time to do some self-care the best way I knew how. I had tons of training in coaching and in the holistic arts and massage and body work and meditation and Reiki and all of that. I already had that before I had started this career, you know, this brief career in the mortgage business. And so I just decided I'm just going to go back to the drawing board and start with what I feel safe in. And that was my healing work. And so I pulled off, dusted off my certificates and my trainings, and I registered my own business, my own practice, printed some business cards, and started to network. Went out to tried, you know, different networking groups and women's groups and BNI, and like I did the whole thing, you know. And it was great, actually. It got me out. It got me meeting more people. I actually found more people and like friends who till this day, like it's been whatever, like I've moved across the country from the East Coast to West Coast, and we're still, you know, I mean, I have best friends now because I went out on my own. And I got into the community. I became people's confidant and coach and helped them. And people have helped me. I found all my whole, you know, so many services I needed in my life, whether it was getting my house painted or decorated or, you know, getting a financial plan or everything. Like all my needs were getting met by just becoming involved in the community. And then my business just blossomed, and it's just been, I've never looked back since then.
Cool. Now you're based on the West Coast now, and yeah. You, like I said, I've participated on one of your summits that you've done, and you've got another one that's coming up. So anybody that listens to this after that's already happened, you'll have to go back to your resources and your website and stuff like that. So let's talk about then what you can do, because I imagine, you know, this experience that we've just talked about is still deep, you know, in the cells. And that's the thing about trauma is, you know, doing our work isn't getting rid of it. It's, you know, kind of learning that some of it is always going to be there. And it is, you know, putting ourselves back into the space of we're not in danger anymore. Like you said, I'm not in danger now, but we have to find a way to gracefully coexist with our traumatic past and, you know, and be able to see brightness ahead in our futures. And I know you help a lot of people with being able to do that. So what are the other ways that people can be supported by you? Because you have a lot of knowledge, not only in your own journey and experience, but also everything that you've learned, you know, to be able to share with other people.
Yeah. This other piece of, you know, this other show, this other iteration that we've been talking about is really about women finding their inner power and using that inner power to step out into the world. And it's very much in line with what you're doing in terms of being fearless, being a fearless woman. And this is called this show is called the Fierce Feminine Freedom Show. And in the Fierce Feminine Freedom, what I really saw was like the, in my culture, I guess I would call it the embodiment of Goddess Kali, who's the fierce dark goddess who's on the battlefield, and she's there to end what no longer serves. So being fearless would be for all of us, as you know, for women to be invited into this possibility of really getting to be in that inner knowing of their own wisdom. It's really about awakening your own inner wisdom and your own inner power to know that you can be, have, and do anything you want. All that is to do is to know what's in the way of you being that. And when we look at like the goddess Kali sort of metaphor, it's like there's nothing in the way of that. like nothing. Everyone, even Shiva, who is her consort and like her equal, he's like, get out of her way. If you know what's good for you, get out of her way now. you're basically over, you know, because she knows what she wants and she's going to get it. She is going to get it because there's nothing in her way. And so to be able to embody that in each of us, because it is in each of us, and it is to awaken that. So the invitation of the work that I'm offering is how you can be your own guide and healer. You can transform and consciously embody that divine fierce goddess within you. And so it's really about awakening at that level for each of us, because that's really, when everything burns down, what's left? That's your truth. So let it burn. Like, burn, baby, burn. Like, let it burn. Let it all go, you know. Just let's let it all burn and let it all go, because your truth will be there. That cannot be destroyed. That cannot be messed with. And it can't be traumatized. That's your true truth. That's the wisdom. That's the place to be rooted, to come back to. So as much as when I'm reminded of that, as much as the statements made or attacks made, and even my own trauma and everything that had happened, it made an impact on my physical, mental, emotional, and yet there's a part of me that was never touched. There's a part of me that was never abused, never hurt, never verbally attacked. When I can be with that, I can know my power, and I can dispel and transmute all those other, like all the toxic debris left behind from those explosions that have happened with my re-traumatization. Mm-hmm. So it's an invitation to keep coming back. Keep coming back to your inner truth, your own inner, what I call the inner freedom practices, which have really been what I've been helping people with, is to shed and let go and release through the work I do and the systems that I've sort of compressed time, if you will, of 25 years of my trainings and turned it into a program that gives people a way to put it into practice for themselves in their own lives and find inner freedom at the core, and then build your life from there.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And the links to all that is going to be in the podcast notes for anybody that wants to, you know, jump over to Reach's work and connect with her. I highly encourage it. I want to say, and I appreciate your summary of, you know, bringing it back to that experience that, you know, we were talking about here on the show, which was, you know, something that was, in a sense, life-changing again, right? You know, trauma survivors have multiple life-changing experiences. It's like one over the other. And every time there is a revelation, something new that's revealed, I have to look at experiences, you know, the bad ones, as there's information to be learned there for me. There's something that I learned about my environment. I learned about people, but most importantly, you know, surviving is bringing it back to ourselves and saying, what did I take from this? And to do it in a way that's positive acting rather than shaming in guilt, even though that may be the first thing we feel, is that small child wound of being ashamed or feeling guilty or feeling insecure or insufficient or scared. But then being able to say, you know, this did give me something else to, you know, strengthen the armor or the fortitude or the wisdom, you know, that we are able to use. And so I don't condone people doing what they did to you ever, in the workplace, or, you know, even what happened to you growing up. But I always want to point out how in awe I am of you for your resilience and finding ways to grow from that, despite, you know, kind of having some handcuffs placed on you a few times in your life, you know, being able to move forward and what you do to be able to help other people. So I want to say thank you for that. I know this was a hard conversation, and I also appreciate that for you to do that for other people, to be able to witness and be able to understand, you know, the depths at which some of us carry with us everywhere we go.
You made it very safe, and I appreciate being in this conversation with you to be able to do that. So thank you for doing these podcasts, and I've listened to several of your podcasts and episodes of your interviews, and I continue to listen to them, and I'm just amazed at the way in which you hold space. And so I'm really so much like rooting for your success, as you put it, putting all this stuff out, because more people need to hear the work that you're doing, because it's really going to change. It's going to change the world. It's going to, having these conversations in really important places is going to be a change we so much need. We all need for us. We need it for our kids. We need it for the future generation. So thank you for creating it.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiracone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quirconi, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.